From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of an upcoming Indiana Wind Symphony concert.
I'll get a sneak peek at the Actors Theater of Indiana's production of Chicago.
And I'll find out about the AIA Indiana Architecture Awards. And of course, there's our arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Dr. Charles Conrad, he prefers Charlie, knows what it's like to sit in a trumpet seat, and he knows what it's like to look at those seats from the podium. Among the many hats he wears is founder and music director of the Indiana Wind Symphony. He dropped in to tell Sharon recently about why he started this ensemble, one of the top community wind ensembles in the country, and about IWS's May 21st concert.
So before we talk about the concert coming up on May 21st, I want to ask you how you got attracted to your career in the first place. You didn't start out as a conductor. You started out as a trumpeter.
Right. I went to the IU School of Music, studied with the legendary trumpet professor, William Adam, and was playing professionally in Indianapolis for a couple of years, right at the point that the Carmel Symphony was started. My wife's the choir director at Carmel High School, so it was kind of a natural that I'd get involved with that. Mm-hmm. And just at that point, their conductor left, and they were just looking for somebody to fill in for a few rehearsals and a couple of concerts, and I got volunteered.
Well, now, surely somewhere along the line, you had, in the process of earning multiple degrees, you had taken some conducting classes, maybe done a little conducting?
Not really. I had just taken the basic undergraduate conducting class at IU that everybody does, whether you're in education or performance. And so once I started with the Carmel Symphony, that's when I decided to start a master's in conducting and actually learn a little bit more about what I was doing.
Of course, you'd been on the receiving end of conducting for many, many years, and that in itself has to be an education.
Oh, sure, but musicians always consider the conductor the enemy, so it was definitely a move to the dark side.
I have a captive conductor, so I'm going to ask you a question that may sound kind of strange, but I'm curious, are there schools of conducting thought or styles of conducting?
Oh, gosh. I think every conductor has kind of a unique perspective, but there are certainly some traits that conductors follow. There are some people that very much stick to the traditional patterns of conducting, show a downbeat to nearly every measure. There are other conductors that are much more minimalist, that conduct only high points, let the ensemble handle the rhythm to themselves. And then there are others that seemingly micromanage every detail of the musical performance. And most conductors will probably use all three of those at some times during their conducting.
Do you prepare the ensemble you're getting ready to conduct at the beginning of the rehearsal process to say, I'm going to give you more direction than usual because it's a contemporary piece and we're less familiar with it, or is it just in the showing?
Oh, probably a little of both. Sometimes if it's a brand new piece and nobody knows it, if there's a recording, we may actually listen to it and follow along with the parts if it's something that's completely new. And if there is no recording, if we're doing a premiere performance or something, we'll probably look through it and do a talk through of the piece before, since it's going to be a new experience for all of us.
What's different about conducting a brass ensemble or the Indiana Wind Symphony as opposed to conducting a more traditional symphony orchestra?
I really don't make any difference at all.
Really?
When I conduct an orchestra, I don't think any differently than I do when I conduct the wind symphony, which is in essence a concert band.
Mm-hmm. Conductors who are dealing with string players are sometimes involved at a very detailed level with the bowings. Are you involved at a very detailed level with breathing?
Well, breathing, I suppose the most direct connection you can make to bowing with a band would be articulation, slurring and tonguing, how short eighth notes are, how much connection there is between two notes. That sort of issue kind of takes the place of bowing issues that you have with an orchestra.
And obviously it's tricky. You can't play every single instrument in the ensemble you're conducting. How do you learn about the limitations and the needs of some of your players when maybe you've never played the euphonium or you've never played the clarinet?
Well, really, the only one I have played is the trumpet. And you hope that you have players that are capable, the principal players that are capable of working with the section, talking about tendencies of instruments in terms of sharp and flat notes, maybe coming up with different fingerings for the woodwind instruments to pull a note into tune that naturally is out. So mostly that's up to the principal players.
Going back to your comment about a lot of players thinking of the conductor as the enemy, I have this great old book that has biographies of some of the great conductors of the first half of the 20th century. It's called Dictators of the Baton.
Oh, I know that one well.
Oh, it's great. Hoy. But I'm curious, do you have a different dynamic as a conductor than with the performers than you did when you were a section player, when you were a soloist or whatever?
I suppose it's similar to being the director of a movie as opposed to one of the actors in a movie. As a musician, you're aware of everything that's going on, but you haven't studied the full spectrum of the piece of music that you're getting ready to perform. And you're not, when you sit inside the ensemble, you're really not in a position to tell much about balance and blend. And that really is probably the most important thing a conductor does, is make sure that the brass section and the woodwind sections are balanced in terms of volume, that the percussion is the right timbre and the right volume. And a lot of times it's tough for a player to know. Because, I give you a humorous story about this. Once, my wife is a soprano, and we went to hear the Berlin Philharmonic. And there, the Philharmonie Hall is in the round. And we happened to be seated, about 20 feet right behind the French horn section.
Hmm.
And they cranked into Symphonia Domestica by Richard Strauss. And I'll never forget the look on her face. And I said, welcome to a trumpet player's perspective of the orchestra. Sounds perfectly normal to me.
It's like that great New Yorker's view of the world where,
right.
You know, whatever's in the foreground. Now, I want to ask you about this. I love the line in your biography on the Indiana Wind Symphony's website that says that your wife married you despite your collection of antique instruments and photos. And so
oh, no,
forth.
It's a good thing I got married before I started doing that, or she probably wouldn't have.
Is there... do you learn anything from each other?
Absolutely. I think the fact that she's working with high school age students and the fact that I'm working primarily with adults, although on a private basis I teach trumpet lessons to middle school and high schoolers, we compare notes a lot. There are some things that are directly correlating, and then there are some things that are completely different. And so I think I learn a lot about how to work with young people from listening to her talk about some of the things that they've done at Carmel High School.
And some principles probably transcend. A good ensemble is good whether it's voices or instruments.
Oh, exactly right. You're always trying to communicate a composer or a composer and lyricist's ideas to an audience, and that's true no matter what level you're working.
What inspired you to start the Indiana Wind Symphony?
Well, it was in 1997, and a lot of us were talking about the fact that there really wasn't a group, a band in Indianapolis that played during the school year rather than during the summer, and played the really serious wind ensemble and band literature. There were several groups, but they all seemed to be vying for exactly the same niche, playing mostly summer concerts, mostly pops, patriotic, mm-hmm. the kind of traditional, more entertaining band functions. And there really wasn't a group that played in the performing arts centers and that played during the traditional concert season.
And that was tackling the more serious literature,
yeah,
too.
Exactly, yeah, exactly right. And there really is some terrific pieces. I love being the conductor of a wind ensemble right now, because I think some of the more exciting music is being written for band, and perhaps it's because it's a little newer medium, and the composers haven't tried everything they can think of quite yet.
You have a kind of a soft spot for contemporary music, I think.
I do, but I also realize that you have to do something that's accessible to the audience as well. And I guess that's one of the nice things about most of the contemporary band pieces, I think, are a little more accessible than perhaps their counterparts in orchestral new compositions.
How is it playing at the Palladium? What is that like?
It's phenomenal. It is just absolutely a beautiful visual and acoustical hall. And I guess the best part about it, it may be the only situation I've been in that you can tell everybody is 100% committed to making all of the concerts be just the best possible situations. From the person who's working in the parking lot to park cars up to the CEO of the Performing Arts Center, you really feel like everybody is behind you and hoping for the best possible results.
It's a fairly live acoustic in there still, although there's some opportunity to mm-hmm. do some altering of the sound or modifying of the sound through drawing the curtains or opening the curtains. How much rehearsal time do you get in there before a concert?
Usually we'll do two rehearsals before a concert, but you mentioned the possibility of change of acoustics. We were shocked at our first tuning concert at how flexible the hall was.
Yeah.
The first piece we played, I think there was literally a 6.5 second ring to our final chord. And so as I was talking to the audience, I was immediately thinking about the things that conductors have to do to adjust to a situation. You might play a little softer. You might play a little slower. You might change some articulations. But I was aware of all the glass panels moving and the curtains at the back of the hall being adjusted. And the next piece we played, the ring was about 2 seconds.
Wow.
So it was incredible the amount of change that they had made just in a couple of minutes.
When you do a concert in there, are those parameters set for the whole concert, or are they changed even within a concert?
Well, I think that's what the tuning concerts were for mostly, was just to set the baseline for an orchestra, the baseline for a piano soloist, where the hall they think is going to work the best. And, of course, a little bit dependent on how big the audience is. Obviously, a full house is going to soak up more sound than a half-full house.
Sure.
I know they can make adjustments during performances if they feel the need to.
Yeah. Your next concert features a young lady who's about the size of the trumpet she plays. How did you discover Natalie?
Well, the first time I met her was actually at the National Trumpet Competition 2 years ago. She was 9 years old, and it was kind of a curiosity how a 9-year-old trumpet player was going to compete at the national competition, junior division, which goes up through basically age 14, possibly 15, depending on the school system, how they handle whether it's 8th grade or 9th grade that goes into high school. And I heard somebody in the testing room playing the Artunian Concerto, and she was right behind me. I could tell the person was very close. I turned around to see who it was, and I didn't see anybody.
Oh.
I literally had to look down because she came up to about my waist.
Oh.
The trumpet literally was stretching from her shoulder to her knee.
Wow.
And I guess the most impressive thing immediately was how she has the strength to hold it up to play such a piece. And she was actually playing the Aretinian Concerto, which is the same work that she's going to play with us on May 21st. And she won the competition. And she not only won the competition, she completely blew the audience away. It was an immediate standing ovation.
Wow.
For her performance. And then she came back and did the same thing again as a 10-year-old, this time playing a C trumpet on the Tomasi Concerto, which is considered more of a graduate level piece. And I know I don't think I ever played the Tomasi till I had graduated from college.
Wow.
And so we were again amazed, this time not so much just at the technical ability to be able to play it, but she also exhibited such phrasing and such musical character and interpretation that you could tell the learning curve was incredibly fast.
There's a mature person inside that little
girl. Yeah, absolutely.
Sharon Gamble with Charlie Conrad, founder and music director of the Indiana Wind Symphony. You can hear their concert with trumpet virtuoso Natalie Dungy on May 21st at the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. Find out more at IndianaWindSymphony.org. Again, IndianaWindSymphony.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Premiering in 1975 and the hit of the 1996 Broadway season, Chicago won six, count them, six Tony Awards, including Best Revival and later the Academy Award as Best Picture of the Year. Bob Fosse's musical is going to be the first production by the Actors Theater of Indiana at their new home in the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Travis DiNicola spoke with director Judy Fitzgerald about the show and all that jazz.
Judy, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Oh, well, it's super to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You guys must be so excited about opening up at the Center for the Performing Arts. I mean, I know this has been a long time coming.
It has been a long time coming, and we are thrilled. I've told a lot of people, it's funny, but I just feel like it's sort of been raining greatness lately. Finally, after all this wait and those wonderful patrons that have joined us new or been with us through this mm-hmm. whole long haul, know how eager and excited we are to finally have our home.
Have
yay!
A home.
And a season. And,
yeah.
And oh.
I mean, this is all a big deal, and we're going to talk about Chicago and your home and all that, but just real quick, though, Actors Theater of Indiana is the only professional company up in Hamilton County.
That's correct.
Professional actors company, theater company. Give me a little bit about equity. Give me a little bit about your background as far as the company goes. You guys have been around for, what has it been, five?
Well, we're starting where we moved here in 2005.
Okay.
And we had our first production actually in March of 2005. So, quick history. I was born and raised in Indianapolis,
mm-hmm.
and we've all been working in the business for many years, like a combined professional 72 years that we've been working, and we all met in New York City, and we had a lot of talk about wanting to
These
start
are the other
company.
Founders of the company.
Yes, Don mm-hmm. Farrell and mm-hmm. Cynthia Collins. Mm-hmm. Those are my
partners in crime,
and I convinced them to Cindy being from New Jersey and Don originally being from Atlanta, but we mm-hmm. all were in New York City together for over 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
So to come to Indy and join me on this venture.
Mm-hmm.
And the big reason, besides how everything, once we moved here, and we actually came here and had our first meeting and talked to Mayor Brainerd that was set up by a close friend, that we saw the vision that was getting ready to happen, and we just felt that it was completely kismet. And on top of that, I found out just a bit before making this decision that I was pregnant with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been known to say that I didn't want to be dragging the stroller down the subway. And I wanted to yep. be here, and all my family's here, and
sure.
I wanted her to be raised the way I was raised, mm-hmm. you know. And so I was lucky enough that everything seemed to just click and fall into place for this to be the perfect perfect place
and
for us.
And you guys have been performing since in a wide variety of locations, or a few locations.
Oh, my gosh. We are theater vagabonds, kind of. Mm-hmm. We have traveled everywhere, and I think that's the thing that really about coming into this new home, that we'll be do some performances in the studio theater, most of them in the 200-seat black box, but we will also get to perform in the Tarkington as well. And we really have become chameleons. We have been everywhere from our first production in 2005, My Way, was at the Zionsville Performing Arts Center in 2005. But we've been there. We've been at the Pike Performing Arts Center, at the Athenaeum, Oak Hill Mansion. I'm trying to think of, of course, the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater at the Indiana Historical Society. And I'm sure there's many more, but we've been pretty
Vagabonds,
much if we can.
Absolutely.
Of course, at the at Clay Terrace, at the performing space there.
Right.
So if there was somewhere to perform, we were in it.
But now you have a permanent home, as you said, at the Center for the Performing Arts, both in the studio and at the Tarkington, which is great.
Yes.
And so you have chosen to open your inaugural season there with Chicago.
That's right. Yeah. We were so fortunate. And we've had other theater companies saying, how did you get the rights to this show?
Yeah.
How did you get it? And I've said, I think they just threw a dart at a dartboard, and we just happened to be there. But, you know, we applied and we got it, and it was just another thing. That's that kind of reigning greatness thing, that it just, we couldn't believe it. When we called, they were like, there's 99% of people do not get this show.
Mm-hmm.
They said, if you did get it, you'd have to wait like 6 months to
get the rights for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Cynthia Collins applied, and it was like a week later, and she said, you won't believe, I just got this email. We got the show, and we're like, we got the show! And so we knew right away, you know, Don, start working on the budget, because this is going to be the biggest, not only is it the biggest moment in our history as Actors Theater of Indiana, but it's, of course, the biggest production. There are 19 folks on stage. It's
huge. You guys tend to do smaller shows.
Exactly.
I mean, professional shows, but smaller shows.
Exactly.
This is a huge musical.
Exactly.
You're directing it.
I am. Michael Worsell is choreographing.
There are so many expectations with the dancing, especially. I mean, you know, Bob Fosse choreography. It's absolutely a great show. Many people, even if they never saw it on Broadway originally or the revival, know it through the movie, of course, which was so popular. But the dancing is so stylized and specific and difficult.
Very, very difficult.
This is a pretty big undertaking.
It's huge. And thank goodness for Michael Worsell and Carol Worsell.
Put
that in, too, who's assisting Michael and is also in the production. They have extensive knowledge of Fosse, and they were all, you know, New York performers and on Broadway and tours. And they, it's amazing what they're doing. I get excited. He gets excited. And if anyone knows Michael, he's a very soft-spoken person. But he's like, I see it, and I'm so excited. And I'm like, me too. And it's nice to have, you know, it kind of is a new, since we're collaborating, Michael and I, that's a brand new, fresh face. And our cast is amazing. And we were fortunate enough that, of course, the show, there's a lot of people that these roles and these are their dream roles. This is the dream show for them.
Now, did you have open auditions, or were there some of this was specific as far as people you knew you wanted? Or
It was a combination.
It was
definitely a combination. We had in mind our really, really great friend Bradley Reynolds from New York City, and then we had other people that we thought would be perfect, because, as you know, this is very specific. The ensemble and you know, Velma and Roxy and Billy, well, and Amos too for Cellophane, they all have to be major triple threats.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sing, act, dance.
Exactly,
right.
And we have, Dwandra Nicoli, who's has done a lot at IRT and the Phoenix, and she's fantastic. She's our Mama Morton, and the wonderful and talented Holly Stoltz is playing our Velma Kelly, and Cynthia Collins, my partner in crime, and in crime in this, is playing Roxy Hart, and Paul Hansen is Amos Hart. And then our ensemble, we have a ton of talented, I probably should say their names real quick, Jenny Shoup, Vicky Klowski, Sally Scarborough, Tim Hunt, Kenny Shepherd, Sean Seeger, Carol Worsell. Please don't let me forget anybody. I think that's it. I'm going to think.
It sounds like a great cast.
Amazing.
So with this production, I'm kind of curious how it comes together just from behind the scenes part for you. I mean, since they've still been, you know, building the studio and that whole additional theater complex up there, have you been able to rehearse in there? What about sets? I mean, because most of the time, I think most of your shows have been kind of pared down in terms of the staging.
Somewhat. It really depends on where we are. I mean, mm-hmm. when we do A Year with Frog and Toad, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge show. Mm-hmm. And we're at Pike Performing Arts Center.
Right.
You know, it's
okay.
huge. We have McGuire Scenic who built our set. It's like the proscenium is like 72 feet. Mm-hmm. I mean, amazing.
Right. That's a big stage to fill.
Exactly.
So how's it working for Chicago for this? Tell me a little bit about, I mean, you were shaking your head about trying to get in there, it sounds like, to rehearse.
We cannot, just with the way the center is, and it is a very expensive, beside our production costs of mm-hmm. how big of a cast, and Kristen Noonan was who I forgot.
There you go.
Of our cast, and everything like that the rent is mm-hmm. is quite high,
mm-hmm.
and so getting in there too early
would cost too much money.
Exactly.
Sure.
So we've been rehearsing at the well-known Performer's Edge, and they've been just amazing mm-hmm. to us. And then McGuire Scenic and Dwayne McDevitt, they've been helping us put our set together and do mm-hmm. all that. So really, we have load-in on the 25th.
Okay.
Our first preview's on the 28th, and we open on the 29th. So we'll see on the 25th. Hopefully, everything will fit. Where, I mean, obviously we've measured it meticulously, mm-hmm. but it's going to be.
This is in the studio, right, where you're performing.
Yes.
Now, and I've heard, because I haven't been in there yet, and I've been inside the Palladium, but the studio is more of like the smaller black box.
Exactly.
And so, you know, often people think, oh, that's just a stage without any set, but no.
Well, it is what you make it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a black box. A black box is basically a black box, and the seating can be reconfigured. It can be proscenium seating. It could be thrust stage, which is like 3/4. It can be in the round, and it can be cabaret seating.
So what are you guys doing?
We're doing thrust.
Okay.
But it also has to do, too, with being able to get enough seats.
Mm-hmm.
You want to obviously have as many seats as possible.
But this will be it sounds like a combination of both sort of high-level professionalism but a very intimate show.
It is. Well, and the wonderful thing about the revival of Chicago, which is definitely where I had a lot of friends in that production and thankfully had connections there with the script and with all of that, it was done at the Encores City Center in New York City mm-hmm. in 1996. And they expected to do 4 shows. And it was so well received because it was so scaled down.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was in black. It wasn't no elaborate sets. Any of this stuff.
Right.
And so that worked really terrifically, is a great marriage for this
okay.
black box. We definitely have a set, but it's not, I mean, we've got people, you know, they're bringing out their chairs, they're taking their stuff. It's very, very, very actor driven.
Okay.
You know, we actually normally would have a lot of people backstage.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll have our stage manager, Jim Carringer. He'll be up in the booth and they'll, of course, our sound and lighting mm-hmm. and all that. But we only have one crew person backstage.
Wow.
Because it is just actor driven.
Yeah.
And it's minimal, but it's amazing because you really can concentrate on the strong music and lyrics of John Kander and Fred Ebb
already.
And of Bob Fosse
great music,
and his choreography,
yeah.
you know, which we really are being true to and making sure we're giving credit that we're being true to that. But just how strong the story, the music.
Tell
it's
me
amazing.
A bit about, I know you guys have different sort of like opening night celebrations and different things going on. Walk me through that real quick.
Okay, we have our first preview on the 28th and the 29th, and we welcome everybody. Please come because it's going to be a real celebration. We're going to have the show, and then afterwards, cast, crew, and anyone who comes to the show
mm-hmm.
is invited to a reception where we'll have champagne and wine and wonderful desserts. Provided by Conn's,
mm-hmm.
and you'll get to meet everybody and talk to everybody and just raise a glass with us to celebrate this really
excellent.
Monumentous moment for Actors Theatre of Indiana.
And then after that, it runs through
May 22nd.
May 22nd.
And we go Wednesdays through Sundays.
Okay.
Wednesday nights. Wednesday, Thursdays are 7:30. And I know all that would be told, but then 8 o'clock on the weekends and 2 o'clock on Sunday.
Awesome. Judy, I know a lot of people have come together to make this possible. You got some other thanks you wanted to give?
I would like to quickly mention our title sponsor, Oppenheimer, and then our other sponsors, REI, Regions, Hall Render, McGuire Scenic, of course, Printing Partners, Wallach Summers and Haas, and the Indiana Arts Commission.
Well, I am looking forward to seeing it and wish you the best with the opening, with the new space.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I hope everybody comes out and sees this show.
Travis DiNicola with director Judy Fitzgerald. The Actors Theater of Indiana production of Chicago opens at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel on April 28th and runs through May 22nd. For more information, visit actorstheaterofindiana.org, and they spell theater T-H-E-A-T-R-E, actorstheaterofindiana.org.
Peep, 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 peep. Hey, Sharon.
Yes?
How are your
Travis?
Peeps?
My peeps are yellow, bright yellow.
Yellow, and
some of them are bright blue, and some are bright purple and
yep.
pink.
I like the
but the
ones.
Real ones, the traditional ones, are yellow.
Yes, they are. Yes,
why do you
put
ask?
One in a microwave now? Anyway.
Oh, you know, somebody showed me a video on YouTube that showed 15 or 20 ways to... destroy peeps.
Oh!
You know, blow them up, set them on fire.
Eat them, no, but anyway.
Bite their little heads off.
Well, I hope you have some peeps for Easter, as will I, and anyone else who is celebrating Easter this weekend, and I'm sure we'll find out some things we can do with peeps on that calendar we call.
What do we do?
Actually,
with peeps?
I've got a great peep idea. The Phoenix Theater is having Phoenix Cheap Peep Seats. That's $15 seats on Easter Sunday. It's the last day for the production of the play This, which is this sort of an adult comedy. People in their kind of late 30s, 40s, getting together, dealing with sort of loss and friendship and all those things that make life worth interesting. And maybe not exactly something you want to take your kids to on Easter, but if you're out looking for something to do on Easter afternoon, this would be a great thing to do. The production is at 2 p.m. Final production of This by Melissa James Gibson at the Phoenix Theater with cheap peep seats. Bring your peeps.
No marshmallows were harmed. Anyway, speaking of those grown-up quandaries, the kids left, the dog died, now what? It is, surprise, a comedy on stage at Theater on the Square just through the end of the month, so your days are growing short to take that in.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Hey, this is a neat tie-in. Jack Milo, who's a local actor and is right now in the production of Beef and Board's Annie Get Your Gun as Sitting Bull, he's also in the movie of Atlas Shrugged Part 1 that opened last weekend. He plays the role of...
No way!
Yeah, Richard McNamara. It's the fifth film that he's been in. So there you go. Reasons to go see that movie or to go see Annie Get Your Gun. And that's probably about the only thing that Atlas Shrugged and Annie Get Your Gun have in common.
I'm searching my brain, my archives, my mental archives for that. Yeah, not coming up with anything else. Hey, the Indianapolis Art Center, of course, is gearing up for the Broad Ripple Art Fair. Can't believe it's almost time for that already. And we'll have more about that very soon. But they're still doing their community nights. These are on Wednesdays, and there's one coming up on May 11th from 6 to 8, and you'll have a chance to work directly with a Broad Ripple Art Fair artist. 6 to 8, it's a free event. It's kid-friendly, family-friendly, so check that out, and especially if you've never been to the Indianapolis Art Center. It's a beautiful Michael Graves-designed building, and it's full of light, and it's bright and cheerful, and there's always something interesting going on. And again, community night, May 11th, 6 to 8. That's a Wednesday night.
Spotlight 2011 is coming up on Monday, May 2nd at 7:30 at Clues Hall. It's a great performance by 20 of Indianapolis' best artists and arts organizations, all benefiting the Indiana AIDS Fund. Tickets start at just $25, and you can get more information at Clues Memorial Hall. And once again, that's Spotlight 2011 on Monday, May 2nd.
Hey, and starting at the end of the month, you can't go just yet, but put it on your calendar. Decorator's Show House. Daily public tours start April 30th, go through May 15th. It's closed on Mondays, but the rest of the days you can go from 11 to 6. It's at Evergreen Manor this year, 4310 North Meridian Street. Showhouseindy.com is how you get more info about that.
If you ever wanted to check out a Bhangra performance. And if you don't know what that is, well, it's this cool mixed music from India that DJ Kyle Long is doing with Cultural Cannibals, and they're putting it together with a live Irish group. So it's Cultural Cannibals and Bollywood Bhangra present Delhi to Dublin. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, it's going to be just a cool night of dancing music down at the White Rabbit Cabaret on Thursday, April 28th. It's an early concert, starts at 8 p.m., and it's a whole mix of everything from tabla and fiddle and sitar and English vocals and electronic beats, and it should be a really good time.
A reminder that you can wind up and show out National Poetry Month with a nice celebration on Tuesday, April 26th. At Ivy Tech Community College, where you can attend what's being billed as a poetry cafe. There's also an open mic period that's part of it, and a program by the Indiana Air Poets, a group made up of Joyce Brinkman, Ruth Ellen Burns, Joe Hightouse, and Norbert Kropf. So you can hear readings and do your own poetry at the open mic, and that's April 26th at Ivy Tech Community College, the main Indianapolis campus. That's a Tuesday.
Very cool. Hey, last thing I got, if you're wanting to see Joshua Bell when he's in town, word has it that the ISO tickets are nearly sold out, but there are still good seats available for the concert at the Palladium on May 5th. He's at the Palladium May 5th and the ISO on the 6th and the 7th.
Beep.
Okay, peeps. Beep. Lots more to peep at and do next week on that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The American Institute of Architects, Indianapolis, wants you to pay more attention to architecture. On April 21st, they gave out their 2011 Excellence Awards at a ceremony at the Idle Drawer Museum, and Sharon invited Lisa Gomperts, president of AIA Indianapolis, and Drew White of Axis Architecture and Interiors, winner of not one but two awards this year, to tell us more about what people and their architects and designers want in contemporary buildings.
So, Lisa and Drew, I want to start first with how you were attracted to architecture. Why architecture?
Well, for me personally, I've just always enjoyed how things come together. Even as a young child, I enjoyed when my parents would purchase some sort of piece of equipment or something, I would always be the one to put it together, and dollhouses.
Really?
And architecture. Yes, it was just always a love that I had of how things came together and assembled themselves. So it seems sort of a natural transition. I had a strong background in math and science, and so combining the art and the engineering together was something that architecture seemed to provide for me.
Are there architects in your family, or
no.
Were there family friends?
No architects.
Wow.
So I had some exposure, I guess, from the Brady Bunch, which for my generation, that was probably the most exposure I had. But no, it was more a love of putting things together.
Television does influence lives, and sometimes in a good way. And Drew, how about you?
Well, for me, it started in junior high school. I took mechanical drafting classes. And
what attracted you to that?
Loved the idea of being involved in industrial arts at the time, in public school in Central Ohio. And so it was fun, you know, figuring out orthographic drawings and being a part of that. But actually,
what is that? What's an orthographic drawing?
Well, it's kind of an axonometric drawing that you would do of different figures, and it was industrial-based kind of education. And later on, I thought I wanted to be a veterinarian and started school at Ohio State and
really
discovered that chemistry was not my choice of hard work, and at the last minute decided to enroll into the School of Architecture there.
So, wow.
Yeah, it was a second
big
choice.
Change.
Yeah, it was.
You're still shaping lives. You're just doing it through architecture and not through people with fur and feathers.
That's right.
The animals. So what does AIA do, both nationally and locally? Lisa, you're the current president of the Indianapolis chapter. What does what does AI do? How was AIA established, and what are its goals?
The American Institute of Architects, or the AIA, is really focused on a few different things. One, education for its members. We provide a lot of programs, particularly the local chapter, so that architects can get the learning units that they need to keep their state registration. Networking is a big piece of what we do, keeping us connected to our legislative representatives, as well as our vendors, who are many of our sponsors. And then from kind of a state standpoint, Drew could probably talk a little bit more about the advocacy piece of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the other thing that AIA does is we promote and celebrate design, good design work. So mm-hmm. That's something that's always kind of been important to me, and also to other AIA members. At the state level, I was president last year of our state chapter. We have about 750 members. We're all very interested in what's happening at the state house every session, so how it affects our profession. So mm-hmm. It's important that we keep an eye on that.
Say more about that. I mean, obviously, green design and specifically LEED certification have been really at the forefront in the last, decade for certain. But what else at a legal level affects the profession?
Well, Lisa probably can talk about this, but it affects architects who are involved in school architecture.
There's been several bills that have come before. There are legislative representatives like stock school plans, for example, as well as energy bills, different things that would affect the way we process paperwork as small businesses. All those things affect our profession. I would say one thing that is probably going to be coming up in the next year or two is a new energy code bill. And how that affects all of our codes and potentially how we will design buildings as we move forward. I mean, many of those things are optional things right now for owners, but if
sure.
that passes, that will start to institute a lot of different changes that we'll need to mandate into buildings.
And when we think of architects, the layman tends to think of new buildings, but you're also involved in retrofitting, re-engineering, recreating buildings. Let's say there's a bill passed that requires all of the existing IPS buildings to meet certain standards. Architects are involved in this as well.
Absolutely, and actually that's where I would say a good bit of business is coming from right now with particularly school construction with property tax caps and difficulties in funding. Schools are looking for options to reduce their operational expenses, and they can do that by changing out their mechanical systems or their lighting systems and reducing their utility bills. So absolutely, that's what a lot of owners are looking at, and there's different grants and funding options to help them with those different projects.
The stock school plans you mentioned, so I'm picturing you go to a shelf or go to a website, and there are three options to build if your school population is, 1,500, you have these options. Is that how that works?
I think that's sort of the intent, is to try and help reduce costs, but I think the thing that it does not account for is that every school system is different.
Right.
Every site is different.
Right.
And to put a building in the same site in 20 different locations does not necessarily work from a energy standpoint, from an access standpoint, programmatically, curriculum, how the schools operate. So I think that's the difficulty. I think every architect approaches a facility or a school facility in particular trying to be as efficient and functional as they can, and the stock school plans I don't think always represent that.
Sure.
It removes the personality too, I think, from the project.
Right.
Both from the owner and the designer.
Right, so. Absolutely. In any given architectural practice, there are architects, but there are lots of other skill sets that are in your offices. We have a fair number of younger listeners who might be thinking, I don't know if I have the math to become an architect, but is there something else I might do to be involved in the profession? What are some of the other skill sets that you have in your office, or some of the job functions that you have in your offices?
Well, we have a small practice. There's 14 of us at Axis, mm-hmm. and one of the strengths of our firm is interior design, interior architecture,
mm-hmm.
and so we have staff that specializes in that kind of work, and that's real important to us. We also have a landscape architect that helps us with our planning,
mm-hmm.
Laying out master plans for sites, and that really helps kind of provide a holistic approach to our design work. And we also have a business development person that's involved in our practice that helps us find work.
So sales and marketing skills
so
as well.
Those are kind of some of the skill sets that we have.
Yeah. And we're a slightly bigger office, about 85 to 90. And we have things like project management as a discipline, which is where I sort of specialize. And the skill sets that I use are not ones that I learned in school at all. It's just skills that I've developed over the years of managing schedules and budgets and working with owners on a daily basis. We also have program management, which is also a lot about managing and working with owners, but specifically looking at strategic visioning for owners. So those are all things that I think, as an architectural discipline, you don't immediately think of, but have unique skill sets to them.
If you're in school, pay attention in every single class, including your English classes. I had to get that in there. Walk us through how the awards program works. So there are about 750 architects statewide. The awards are specific to Indianapolis, or is it statewide?
The Excellence Awards is specific to Indianapolis-based architects.
And how many projects are, it's a submission process. People say, oh, wow, this project is pretty fabulous. But what's the timeline? Because most things aren't designed and built in a single year.
No, and sometimes we'll have categories for unbuilt work that are in the process of being designed. This year we had 7 to 8 different categories ranging from interior design to renovation to new construction. And we'll have anywhere from 30 to maybe 60 entries
a
year. And usually somewhere between 7 and 10 are awarded each year in those different categories.
And who adjudicates this process?
Well, we usually try and find a chapter, an AIA chapter, somewhere in the country that's similar in size to us.
Uh-huh.
This particular year, we used the chapter from South Carolina to judge so that we're getting an objective opinion. We try and have a jury that is not Indianapolis-based to take a look at our different award submissions.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
good.
We have about 350 architects in the Indianapolis chapter, so it's about half of the state.
Wow.
And
your firm ended up with two of the awards this year. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about first the really high profile one that, bless your hearts, you've gotten so much great press about the Nature Conservancy project. Talk about getting that project in the first place. How did you win that contract in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. It was a kind of an interviewing process, but also they asked us to provide some initial concepts pro bono as part of our interview. And that, you know, it's an issue that comes up in front of us all the time as a firm. Do we want to do this? Do we want to be a part of this? And we felt very strongly about the Nature Conservancy mission, and we also are neighbors to their current location. I think that helped us a lot.
Sure.
In the interviewing process. And we for our firm, it was kind of our initial Genesis lead green project. And so we knew going into the interview we had to convince them, even though we hadn't done a green project yet, that we were committed to it and really thought it was important for the city to do this. So
you
were
both
very excited.
You were both kind of pioneers in it,
yes.
Because you did all sorts of new ways of engineering and designing from the green roof to, tell us about some of the features.
Yeah, some of the technology features. There are 4,300 feet geothermal wells that provide the heating and cooling for the building. We have a green roof that occupies the entire upper level of the building, and through that green roof we filter rainwater into a cistern that's in the basement that provides irrigation for our plants but also helps assist our toilets. So it's a gray it's a gray water system.
Brilliant.
And other technologies that are being employed there, daylight control systems, which means that if lots of light's coming through the windows, the lights go out, which helps us with energy use, but also helps us not to have to cool the building as much. So those are some of the technology features. I guess from a building design standpoint, we have passive solar with screens that we've placed on the southern facade, and the building's orientation is east-west orientation, which helps with heat gain on the east and west. So just some real common sense things that we used on the site design.
You know, it's always struck me that architecture is so interesting because it bridges the world of the science and art. There's the engineering, there's all of the working within the limitations and the advantages of the physical built environment that you just talked about, but it's artistic as well, because you could build a really ugly building using all of the technology you just suggested. How do you think of architecture as art?
Well, I think with any facility, we're trying to make a facility that people feel good in, something that people respond positively to, people want to be in that facility. We hope, at least the projects I work on, that it represents the organization or the owner and helps further their mission and goals. And, you know, with all of the new green technology that's out, I think it's been a neat way to kind of push that technology with each one of the new facilities that we do, taking those kind of to the next step.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess for us, we're very fortunate. Currently, we're designing a project for the Indianapolis Art Center, and it'll be a new structure that encompasses a new ceramic studio and a new sculpture studio. So there, as architects, we're able to form space that supports the education of art. So we're very excited about being involved in that kind of a project. That doesn't happen very often.
Sharon Gamble with Lisa Gomberts, president of AIA Indianapolis, and Drew White of Axis Architecture and Interiors. Axis won two AIA 2011 Excellence Awards for their work on the Nature Conservancy and the interior redesign of Business Furniture Showroom. You can see pictures and learn much more at AIAIndyChapter.org. Again, AIAIndyChapter.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra, from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4, when I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Opera's La Traviata.
I'll find out what's going on at the Gregory Hancock Dance Theater.
And I'll get a preview of the annual Broad Ripple Art Fair. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.